As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Total Soccer Show and our latest listener questions episode. My name is Ryan Bailey, and joining me today is a man whose answers to listener questions are much like his beard. They're long, but they don't need trimming. Taylor Rockwell.
That is correct. I appreciate that introduction. I'll say my beard is also very curly, so much like my answers, it circles back in on itself. I feel like that fits.
See, that was part of my original script, but I didn't want to be rude, Taylor.
they're long and meandering and sometimes get right back to where they were and sometimes end at a point. How about that?
And sometimes should just be completely shaved away.
Disagree.
Hard disagree from me too. Just kidding. Also here, you might have heard him giggling just there, is a man who loves the Olympics more than life itself. It's Graham Ruthven. Graham, you adore the Olympics in all forms, right?
Oh, yes. I am an expert now in all things Olympics. The USA are apparently now bad at women's soccer and basketball. And the UK, Great Britain, are still really good at the dancing horses.
Horse dancing is the greatest of all Olympic sports. We can agree on that, Graham. And one that I've really gotten into this time around is the skateboarding. Watching here in England on the BBC commentary, and you've got the commentator saying, "Oh, that ollie he just flipped was so fresh. That backside kick flick fakie nose grind was on the nose, baby." And it's just, it's kind of strange for Olympic commentary. Yeah.
There's just some countries that don't go together with some sports. I think Britain and skateboarding goes together as well as, I think, Italy and rap, really. So,
I mean, I won't diss the Italian rap till I've heard it, frankly.
Well, you're going to
hear
it.
I do sort of picture, like, the very stuffy, tuxedoed commentators trying to do skateboarding. And I'm sure they have people who do it appropriately and have some level of insight and aren't just horrified and monocles falling out. But that is a more fun way to picture it being covered in England.
But it was quite fun watching the skateboarding, but then the very posh commentators say, "Oh, that was baller." And you're like, "Oh, no, you don't need to say that."
Oh, boy. Yeah. Oh, boy.
Completing our lineup, by the way, is a man who is unlike the USWNT because he doesn't need to fix a darn thing, Joe Lowry.
Oh, Ryan, if only that were true. On a different note, I missed you guys. This is fun. Even though I was just sitting in the background waiting for permission to speak in that banter bit, it's fun to listen, you know?
Joe, I would like a 5-word summary of either Olympic skateboarding or the USWNT at Olympics. Go.
Oh, I've also watched some Olympic skateboarding, so I'll go that route because we talked plenty about the US women's national team. It's not my favorite. It's so cool and every Olympic sport is so impressive. This is way more than 5 words. I forgot what my restriction was.
I'll summarize, Joe. I think I got it.
Okay,
you.
Go ahead.
No. You finish your point and then I'll summarize the 5 words.
It's fun and it takes an incredible amount of skill, but I just haven't been able to get into it. So maybe people will roast me for that, but that's just my opinion.
Not my favorite is fine, is how I'm summarizing for the 5-word limit.
Thanks, Taylor.
No problem, buddy.
Wow. Joe not liking the skateboarding is making me flip an emotional 180 ollie here because I was enjoying it very much. How strange.
That's okay. It's okay.
Something else I was enjoying, by the way, my favorite story this week. Before we get to listener questions, this story, I don't know if you saw it, gents, about Wayne Rooney injuring one of his own Derby County players in training. Jason Knight, it was during a practice game. The Republic of Ireland midfielder was left with an ankle injury that could see him sidelined for up to 3 months by Wayne Rooney. He was joining in because they were short on numbers in training. That's not ideal, Joe, is it?
I mean, were they really short on numbers in training? Wayne Rooney just feels like the kind of coach that will just come in to any drill. Usually it's the assistant coaches who come in and fill out the numbers. He feels like a guy who will actually step in no matter what. If they have 22 guys and they can go 11v11, I think somebody's sitting so that Wayne can play somewhere in central midfield.
I like the idea of managers seeing this as some form of tactic to get players out of their team. So Solskjaer is looking at Phil Jones right now with a two-footer in mind. He's going to go flying in.
I think the biggest concern here is I read on Reddit earlier that Jack Wilshere is now training with Derby, and he is literally made of glass. So if Wayne Rooney comes near him on one of these teams, I'll be quite concerned for him.
Can I just say I'm choosing to believe that Wayne Rooney saw that photo comparison that was doing the rounds of him compared to Steven Gerrard and just realized, like, all right, I got to get back to it. I got to get serious about my fitness. And I'm going to assume that with Wayne Rooney, it's a 0% or 100% effort sort of situation. And so he went all in on that tackle, trying to maybe shed some pounds, and instead he shed a player.
Well, Taylor, when you talk about the Rooney photos that are doing the rounds, I thought you were going to be talking about the photographs of him in a hotel with 3 21-year-old
girls. I thought
that was
going in a different direction, I have to say.
Yeah. I missed that one. Apparently, my Wayne Rooney radar, is what I was trying to say, their Google alert situation is not set up properly. I have definitely missed that story.
So between those photos and the injury in training, Rooney's tackle getting him in trouble in more ways than one. Thank you very much. I'm here all week. Thank you very much. Try the veal. All right. Shall we get to the listener questions? Why don't we? Let's start off with one from Mr. Matt Koss. Thank you for your question, Matt. What countries have a club team in their domestic league that would beat their national team? Would Bayern Munich beat Germany? Would Real Madrid or Barcelona beat Spain? I don't think any MLS team could beat the US MNT, says Matt.
That sounds like a challenge.
I mean, yeah, we can get to that part of the question. I seem to remember years ago, I might have made this up in my head, but many years ago, the winner of the Spanish division played the national team in some kind of community shield kind of thing, which would be awesome. I might have made that up, and there might be some leagues that used to do that in the past. But my initial answer, Taylor, here is that, yes, every top five European team's winner could beat their national team. Is that right?
Pretty much. I would agree with that. I think especially if we're not doing this in a sort of FIFA vacuum, like in FIFA, there's no background, there's no training, and then you're basically putting, like, Chiellini could play for Juve and for Italy. If we're making them choose, I think then it's a more interesting conversation. But yeah, I think if you're putting Bayern Munich up against the German national team and maybe Bayern Munich keep their German players, I think Bayern Munich are going to win. I think the same for PSG, though you never know, instability, but there's also instability with the French national team. I think Man City and Liverpool would probably both be able to get by England. Yeah. I think Juve up until recently could probably have handled recent Italy. I don't know about this time, and especially if Chiellini and Bonucci played for Italy instead of Juve. But yeah, I'm with you that I think for any number of reasons, strong club teams are going to beat strong national teams.
So we're approaching that, Taylor, when you say Chiellini could play for both sides, for example, like the Street Fighter 2 rules, where, you know, when you would Guile fighting Guile and you have one in slightly different color camo, that's what you're going for, right? You're duplicating players. Because obviously
and
with someone like...
They also have to have the Guile flat top and say Sonic Boom routinely.
Sonic
but
Boom!
Yes. The best one. I remember thinking that was the coolest thing ever and then realizing it wasn't an actual power you could master, but was instead just sort of things being loud.
The thing about Street Fighter 2 was the bonus round where you got to beat up a car. Who beats up a car? That looks like it would really hurt your fists.
Anyway. E-Honda does very well. That's the answer. I've played too much Street Fighter.
And we've gone slightly off topic already. Graham, I'll bring you in here. What are your thoughts on this? And what are your thoughts on Street Fighter 2 rules in this? Because if you're thinking about something like a team like Man City, who have like at least 4 starting England players, or maybe 3, if you can't feel... let's say 4. What do you make of that, the proposition here?
Yeah, I mean, well, the first thing I was going to say with Bayern Munich and Germany, is there a difference? I feel like there's a big overlap there, and they're just the German national team that plays in the Bundesliga. But Yeah, I don't mean to slap down this question too much, but I'm just of the opinion that club teams have such a natural advantage due to the amount of time on the training pitch, for instance, and just that that a manager can create a culture. And the number of times we mentioned it a lot about Roberto Mancini's Italy team during the Euros podcast. We always said they're like a club team, and that was meant as a compliment. So I would even go kind of further than Taylor and say I think a lot of club teams would beat their national teams. I mean, if you're going through the Premier League, like, you know, City, Liverpool, United, not Arsenal. Yeah. They wouldn't be
top teams, Joe. Top teams.
An example that I would draw as a Scot, I would look at Scotland and Rangers. So Rangers, obviously the Scottish champions. I think on paper, there's no denying that Scotland are a better team than Rangers. But if those two teams were to face each other, I would expect Rangers to beat the Scotland national team. Just because they have a lot more time in the training pitch and all the reasons I mentioned previously. Yeah.
Joe, your thoughts on this question? And Joe, would you like to see this as a regular fixture? The thing I might have made up, where the national team plays the champions as a preseason warm up. That would be pretty cool, wouldn't it?
Oh, I'd love that. It really would be straight out of FIFA. We'd have to work on our cloning technology to make it the full simulation. But yeah, I like the idea, Ryan. And I agree with the premise that we've kind of established here that most elite club teams, and Graham even took it a little further, but generally speaking, most elite club teams would beat most elite national teams. I think that's a fair summary here. I will say, though, I think of the top five leagues, I think Italy would give last year's Inter Milan Serie A title winners some trouble. And I think Spain would give Atleti or Barca or Real Madrid trouble, because Barca and Madrid are not at their height right now. They're not the height of their powers. And Atletico Madrid is a very strong team, but it is still a contrast in styles with how Spain play. So I think maybe with those two exceptions, I don't know, France as well could give PSG some trouble, but they're so hot and cold sometimes. I think there are national teams that would give the top club teams in their country a battle. But most of these cases, I completely agree with Graham. These teams have so much time to train. And so if we're looking at it outside of a vacuum, if we're looking at it where these teams have the same training situations, most often it's going to go to the club team. That said, I think there are a few examples of national teams, a few examples on top of the ones I said could give teams trouble that would beat the top teams in their domestic league. Mexico, I think, would beat any team from Liga MX, even though there is real talent there. The U.S. men's national team, I think, would beat any team from Major League Soccer, and that's in the question there from Matt. There are others as well. Portugal and Brazil would beat, I think, teams from their domestic league, or certainly they're a lot more talented. So this was a fun thought experiment, and I don't think it's necessarily as clean cut as maybe I thought it would be at first.
I think, Joe, if anything, you've kind of convinced me that this is a thing we should be doing. Sorry, Ryan, Joe who gets the credit. Because when you're talking about like this being a battle and could give a team some trouble, I think that might be a useful thing. Like, we think about Spain, who play a very similar version of tiki-taka to Barcelona, and they're playing a high possession style. It's not the most intense, attacking sort of approach. And to find a team in La Liga that has caused Barcelona problems would be maybe a good way for Spain to go about finding an opponent who has played against tiki-taka, has a way to sort of cause tiki-taka problems, and then how do you adjust to that? It gives you sort of learned experience. So I could see a world in which they're playing, I don't know, Real Sociedad or whoever that bogey team might be as a way to sort of give them more familiarity with that sterner opposition. I doubt it ever happens. I think it has happened in the past, as Ryan said, and I think I've talked about watching the U.S. play Derby County way back when in the 90s. But I doubt it comes back, but I still think it could be an interesting experiment. And I think, Joe, to your point, it is probably the case that if your best players are playing in one of Europe's top five leagues, like, but not your own league, then I think a lot of the time, if you're basically a selling league or a developmental league, I don't think you're going to have clubs that can challenge the national team. If you're one of those more established leagues with a bit more money, I think you probably can.
There's got to be a few nations, like small nations, who have players playing at a high level who aren't playing their domestic league. The one that springs to mind would be Croatia. Surely the Croatian national team would beat any domestic team from Croatia.
Denmark, yeah. Too. Yeah. I mean, there's a good few of those, I think, Graham. Yeah, I'm totally with you.
Are we totally brushing over the MLS part of this question, Joe? You did mention that you don't think an MLS team could beat the USMNT. Are you saying like the Sounders wouldn't have a chance, for example?
Would they have a chance? Yes. Like the top 5% of MLS could give the full U.S. men's national team a game. But right now, I think we're all caught up in the U.S. men's national team at the Gold Cup, where we're not seeing Christian Pulisic or Gio Reyna or Tyler. I mean, we're not seeing the top, top players. Mm. With all of those guys in the mix, the U.S. should win that game 9.9 times out of 10.
All right, let me slightly flip the question. Which national team could Inter Miami beat right now, Joe? And why is it Scotland?
Zero? Oh, gosh. No. They would have no chance against Scotland. Inter Miami
is... Can we play them then?
Yeah, you know, go for it, Grant. Inter Miami...
just confidence builder.
Cincinnati had a dumpster fire at their training the other day. Like an actual dumpster being caught on fire right outside of their training ground. That should have been at Inter Miami's training ground in Fort Lauderdale, because that is much more fitting for where they're at right now.
Oh, dear. Any thoughts on that? Anyone
have to
else?
Go far. Man, I'm trying to think here. I'm trying to think of a team that is in like absolute dysfunction. Inter Miami. Yeah, I can't think of a national team that like that really isn't that level of disarray. I mean, I guess probably if you're going to like the like any team ranked 100 or lower in the FIFA World Rankings, maybe Inter Miami can get a result. But even then, I think there's some teams that would cause them problems.
Faroe Islands, someone like that, maybe.
Ooh,
well, we drew against them.
Are we playing home or away? That's another one.
Depends what the climate is as well, doesn't it? Because they're used to a much different climate to Miami. Anyway.
Yeah. No, I've heard the Faroe Islands are the Miami of wherever the Faroe Islands are. I've always heard that.
They're basically Scotland, aren't they, Graham?
Yeah, I think they've got a better climate than us.
Saying something. That Aww. Is saying something. Matt, thank you very much for the question. Let's get another one in before we go to a break. This is from Chris Brannigan. Is there a strategy for where to play the ball at kickoff? It seems like more often than not, the ball is passed backwards and immediately booted downfield to a group of opposing defenders in wait. The kickoff is quite important, gents. It's a very important set piece. It's the one set piece you're guaranteed to have at least one shot at as a team. I think Chris might have been watching 90s Wimbledon, because that was the sort of what Wimbledon used to do, hoof it down to a wide player and lose the ball 60 to 70% of the time. But in that strategy, and that's something that's kind of done these days as well, the idea of hoofing it downfield, it seems dumb, but you're bringing the ball to the attacking third. And there is a school of thought that, say, if you boot it out near the corner flag, the opponents have a disadvantage from a throw-on because they've got one player off the field. So there is some logic to that. I'm rambling, though. Taylor, I'll come to you on this question.
Yeah, I think you've already hit upon the way it can be utilized pretty effectively. I would say you don't have to go backwards anymore, right? Or no, the ball doesn't have to go forwards anymore. You can play it straight backwards. But it is like a restart, so you can't just kind of dribble away. So what I think I tend to see is the ball pass back to like a central midfielder who takes a touch, everybody runs forward, and that ball gets hoofed long. And yeah, Ryan, I think part of that is either you're putting the defense under immediate pressure in their own at a third out wide, or you're putting it out of bounds and they're taking a throw, but then you can step everybody high, defend that throw in, and it can be difficult to find somebody open if you're that defensive team. I think there's also an element of if they're slow starters or if they're not sort of ready for you to launch the ball at them, you can catch them out, you can make them uncomfortable, and you can sort of dictate control of the game for at least those opening few minutes as the other team is sort of defensively reeling and scrambling and trying to get back into their style of play. If you continue to be proactive and press them, I think you can cause big problems.
Yeah. Joe, seems like a bit of a numbers game, doesn't it? Either hoof it downfield and try and get the numerical advantage and try and get into the attacking third, or you're Man City and you pass it backwards to a defensive midfielder and you start the build.
Right. Yeah, I see those as the two primary approaches. You play backwards, get into your possession setup and attack from near midfield or probably a little deeper in your own half. Or you do look for a second ball, or maybe it's not even a second ball. I guess there's two different paths you could take from the second hoofing it approach that Chris is talking about. You either look for that second ball and you send a couple big forwards over there and try to win the ball and then play and attack from there. Or you just immediately start to press. And I think that second one there is maybe what more teams do. Because there's a lot to be said about field position in soccer. We don't talk about it so much in that kind of American football language. But if you can, and Ryan, you already explained this, if you can win the ball way upfield after a throw-in, or even if the ball never goes out of play and you just immediately go and counter-press in that area or high-press, you can win the ball and the opposing defense at that point might be a little bit scrambled. And so you have a chance to advance the ball without having to go through all of the hoops of detailed possession play, without having to pass the ball 24 times to move it into the attacking third. You can do it in two actions or three actions instead of 20. So that's kind of the thinking. And a lot of teams don't do it very well, but there are teams out there who can use the kickoff to their advantage. And I think teams continuing to get smarter about how they do that will be a development over the next 5 or 10 years.
Graham, is there anything more fun in soccer than a kickoff with all 10 outfield players lined up on the halfway line, ready to rush into the opponent's half for a kickoff?
Well, the thing is, I'm surprised we don't see that a little bit more. I think we saw it, I can't remember who it was, but I remember talking about it in one of the weekend reviews last season. And I think maybe kickoff is still overlooked in terms of the value that it can bring to a strategy. I know you're not kicking off all that often. You're a minimum of twice, and I suppose if you concede, you'll do it a few more times. But I just wonder whether that's the remnants of the limitations of what you used to be the case at kickoffs. So obviously, as Taylor referenced, the rules were changed. How long ago was that? 3 seasons ago, maybe? You used to have to play the ball forward. And so what that meant was you had to have two players at the centre circle, because obviously the one player needed to pass the ball to the other. And that's changed. And now you only really have one player there to pass the ball backwards. That tends to be the case. It tends to keep possession. But I do wonder, with teams looking to things like throw-in coaches, you know, famously Liverpool have a throw-in coach. I do wonder whether we might see a kickoff coach before too long. And as I say, I'm just surprised we don't see more teams charge opponents right from the start, particularly when they're looking for a late goal and stoppage time. If you concede late on, obviously there is an element of risk in that, you know, you really need your defense to push up quickly to pick off any second or third balls. Otherwise, there's just a complete vacuum in the center of the pitch. But if you're trailing with a minute to go or 2 minutes to go, then, you know, it seems like a risk worth taking. So it wouldn't surprise me if over the next few seasons we see teams focus more on the kickoff as a strategy, just because of the way that the rule changes have kind of opened things up a little bit.
And Graham, one thing that you've like reminded me of, the person who I can remember doing that is Juan Carlos Osorio. I think it was with Mexico in the Copa America Centenario in 2016, but he sends out his lineup. Everybody knows it's going to be a back three. They know exactly how Mexico are going to set up because the personnel sort of fit into this like 3-4-3, 3-5-2 that they were going to roll with. They go with the kickoff. They boot the ball long. And I remember trying to figure out when they changed their formation. And we realized they changed in like the 15th minute. And we went back. And we realized they hoofed that ball long. And immediately as everybody goes to press, they also changed into a 4-3-3 shape and stuck that way. And so there was a way that they basically set up so that the opposition could see them really clearly in one shape, and then as soon as they kick the ball, they change their shape entirely. So I think you're right that there are ways that you can utilize kickoff in the moments before kickoff that teams will probably start to toy around with a bit more.
I think I've missed my calling in life, and it is to be a kickoff coach for a very top-level team where they might only take one kickoff in the game. I think that's what I should be
picture,
doing.
All I picture now is the original Ted Lasso video when he's just screaming, "Kick it!" And that's all I picture with the kickoff coach there.
Excellent stuff. All right, Chris, I hope that answers your question there. I think it's a very interesting part of the game that's not often talked about. So thank you very much for that question, Chris. We'll be back with more after these messages.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Total Soccer Show, we have returned. We are answering your questions, and here's one from Mr. Drew Strong. If we had a competition that was every 4 years and featured national teams from North and South America, would people around the world care more like they do with the Euros? Would the increased quality of the competition benefit the United States men's national team? What would be the positives and drawbacks to such a tournament? Joe, I'll come to you first. We're kind of talking about a Copa America Gold Cup hybrid here, I guess.
Yeah, and something similar-ish to that has been done in the past. But if they went all in on this thing and actually made it happen, I think people would absolutely care more, especially if it's a substitute for the Copa America and the Gold Cup, if those tournaments go away and it does become North, Central, and South America's Euros. I think people would absolutely be more invested from all over the world, not just in this region, because of scarcity and that whole idea of there's not as much soccer going on. And so this is the big event, you know, alternating years with the World Cup or however you want to set that up. There would be some smaller Central American and Caribbean nations that probably wouldn't be too happy about this. But for the U.S. and for Mexico and for a handful of other teams in CONCACAF, if you add them into the 10 teams that are usually in the Copa America and you make it a 16-team tournament, so you've got 10 from South America, 6 from North and Central America in CONCACAF, I think that would be a great show. I think it would be good for the pockets, for the parties involved there, federations and the nations competing. But I also think it would be good for not just the United States, but the rest of the region, the rest of the countries in CONCACAF that would be competing in this. You get more exposure to higher level competition, which just isn't available right now in CONCACAF, really. And so that's a huge benefit. It's going to develop talent. Players are going to learn things in those games that you just really can't learn in other games. And if you keep CONCACAF Nations League, which has had a lot of people poke fun at it, but in this alternate reality, it would become quite important because then it kind of would be a different take on the Gold Cup against the regional competition. And you have this big tournament as well. I like this idea a lot, Drew. I think this could be a ton of fun.
Yeah. Graham, what do you think about it? Do you like the idea of it being every 4 years rather than biannual like the Gold Cup, or every 1, 2, 3, 4 or whatever years Copa America decides it spaces its tournaments?
Yeah, I think, you know, what makes the World Cup so special is that it only happens once every 4 years, although it seems like Arsene Wenger, of all people, wants to change that. I guess in terms of the question, I am probably the, quote, people around the world, in that I don't watch much of the Gold Cup. I watch a little bit of the Copa America. And from a European perspective, there's just absolutely no doubt that more people would care about a North and South America hybrid competition. The Gold Cup, I have to say, just doesn't register at all here, I'm afraid, to the point that even some big football fans might not even know what it is. The Copa America, even with Argentina and Brazil and lots of players that European fans know, again, doesn't really register, even though it was on British TV here, but it wasn't one of the main channels. Obviously, the time zones don't help and things like that. But I think a hybrid competition would definitely help in that regard. I mean, we're competitions are kind of going in that way anyway. I mean, Qatar are in the Gold Cup this year, the Copa America Centenario, I think, you guys will be able to correct me on this, it had invited teams. The USA was in that, wasn't mm-hmm. it? Weren't it? Yeah, and, you know, Australia and Eurovision and,
so,
yeah. Who cares about confederations? They should just create one big confederation for all of world soccer and they can call it something like, I don't know, the Fédération Internationale de Football Association. just a name that I've thought of.
And they should organise a tournament every 4 years, Graham, and everyone's invited. What do you think?
Yeah, great idea. Nobody's ever done it before.
Good, good.
So I think I disagree with both Joe and Graham a little bit. And Graham, I'd like to ask you, like, if there's no real interest in the Gold Cup at all, and if there's very limited interest in Copa America, why would there be more interest if those two things combined?
Because you've got the South American teams, your Argentina and Brazil, and then you have American branding and spectacle and ticker tape, and boom, you've got, you know, a massive tournament. No, but it's a fair point. Like, I guess maybe my theory falls down there a little bit. I just think because you're adding two confederations, I guess maybe what I'm getting at is people would certainly care more about that than the Gold Cup. which just, yeah. I'm afraid, just doesn't register at all here. One thing I was going to ask you guys was, looking at it from the other side, by you guys, I mean from the people who have the American perspective on this, obviously the theory is competition would be good for the USA in terms of growing players and becoming a better team, going from a big fish in a small pond to a slightly smaller fish in a bigger pond. But how much would American fans miss winning as they do in the Gold Cup? Because it's a little bit of a cliche, maybe it's not a cliche, you guys can tell me, that one of the biggest factors in the sports that American sports fans are interested in is if they can win it. And obviously, you know, you look at the Olympics, it seems like the Olympics is a huge deal in America because you guys do really well in the Olympics. So would going into a hybrid North and South America competition where the USA wouldn't be the giant in that tournament, would that effect have, would that maybe have a detrimental effect in any way?
I think this is just my opinion, and I don't think I'm in a mood here, but I think if the U.S. were to enter into that competition, I think it only makes people more interested, even if they aren't winning it or even getting out of the group necessarily, because to some extent, I think the Gold Cup is a poison chalice of a lot of neutrals or sort of casual U.S. fans who will get into the national team way more for the World Cup or for World Cup qualifying, I think also aren't as interested in the Gold Cup. Like, it's maybe a bad example, but like my in-laws and my parents are like, they are always into the U.S. when they're at a World Cup, the men and the women. But a bunch of them have asked me, like, is there a tournament happening right? Like, what's going on? Like, I think people don't always know. And then I think the people that do are the very, very dedicated people who then sort of, if not dismiss it, sort of tend to say, it doesn't really matter till the knockout round. And even then, it doesn't really matter unless we're playing Mexico in a final. But if we don't make it to the final, then things have gone horribly wrong, and that matters too. And so I think if you're playing in an enlarged competition against stronger opponents, even if the U.S. isn't winning, I think there's an idea of there'll be more interest here, I think, in the U.S. and just basically in the Western Hemisphere. And I think that will get more people interested in watching the U.S. play Brazil and U.S. play Argentina. Even if they end up losing those games, I think it also prepares them better for the World Cup and for World Cup qualification and for the stronger teams you're going to play. So I think it would be better even if we run the risk of never winning it. That's my thought, at least. Joe, what about you?
Yeah, I agree with every single word you just said, Taylor. Right. I think the amount of people that actively care about the U.S. in the Gold Cup, and even more than that, care about the U.S. winning the games against smaller teams in the Gold Cup, is just so much smaller than the people who would care about the U.S. in a bigger tournament playing the teams that Taylor just talked about. So yeah, I think it would be a good thing for the U.S. in that way.
And I really don't think Graham Ryan, feel free to correct me of this assumption. I just don't think that prioritizing getting European viewers is the way to go, because I don't think you're going to get that, especially if it's in competition with the Euros. I think there's always going to be an element of, oh yeah, it's that Western Hemisphere thing, like Canada's involved, I don't know, the US, whatever. Like, we're just going to pay attention to the Euros. I think there's probably other countries that would care and other areas of the world that would care. And maybe if you made it invitational where Australia do get an invite instead of being in Eurovision, maybe they take that one. Or you can making it like another World Cup at that point, to Graham's point.
But they're not giving up Eurovision, by the way.
Okay. I hope not. But I would say, like, I think a lot of it has to do with the appointment viewing aspect of things. And I think Brazil is probably appointment television, Argentina, Uruguay, Colombia sometimes, Mexico sometimes. But the United States, like, can either you, Graham, or you, Ryan, other than like in the last couple of years, think of a time that you were like, ooh, this U.S. team, I can't wait to see blank. Like, it might have been when there was a player in form. But aside from that, I don't think the U.S. has ever really had the level of talent or the names that would make an English person or a German person stay up into the wee hours of the night or early morning to watch the U.S. play.
You would get some Chelsea fans at the moment with Pulisic,
yeah,
obviously.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right.
Yeah, but I mean, I think those guys becoming those names, the Pulisic, the rain, like, I don't want to do the list. I'll just say Pulisic, I think. Reyna does that. McKinney, I think, probably, if he continues to have success with Juve. And I think there's more players that will do that. And once the U.S. becomes a bigger draw, a team that people do want to watch, I think Mexico is probably already in that category. I think Canada is moving towards that as well. And I think once you have more teams that have more players that people want to see, that neutrals want to see, you'll get eyes on you. When Didier Drogba was playing for Ivory Coast, I think there was always that was an immediate draw. I'll watch the Ivory Coast play because Didier Drogba is so good. I want to see what he's going to do for his country. I don't know if the U.S. has that person that people are sort of that interested in the way other smaller countries tend to have. Once they do, I think maybe there is more interest, and then combining the tournaments creates even more interest.
Yeah, I do agree, Taylor, that chasing like European views and European interest, it shouldn't be the barometer for success for something like this as well. And I think when it comes to Copa America and when it comes to things like the Gold Cup, Graham's right in the limited interest on this continent. I'm in the UK at the moment. But I think it's time difference is a lot of it, because prime time in the US, prime time in the Americas is middle of the night for Europe. So it's tough to get a lot of eyes on that kind of thing. But that's a very good question from Mr. Drew Strong. Thank you very much for that one. Let's get another one. This is from Dan Martini. This question neither shaking nor stirring me, Dan. When players are checking in for the Euros, he says, the fourth officials check the bottom of their cleats. From my research, says Dan, metal studs are legal. So what else are they checking for? I've done a little bit of research here, but Joseph, I'll come to you first.
Yeah, this is an interesting question. I did not know the answer to this. So I went into the IFAB rule book, baby, into the laws.
Woo!
And found out that they're really, it is a dark place, Graham. You're absolutely right about that. It's a sad corner of the internet. There's not a lot of information.
The rule book got a woo. That's shocking.
Was that from Ryan?
Yeah,
Ryan,
I believe it was.
Okay, come on.
I'm a stickler.
There aren't a lot of guidelines from IFAB as far as equipment or boots. Graham, I know you hate the word cleats, so I'm going to say boots as much as possible. Apparently, according to IFAB Law 4, a player must not use equipment or wear anything that is dangerous. And that, gentlemen, is the extent of the laws that I could find that related to this topic. So I did some more reading, some more research, and it seems like from everything I could find, the referee is just looking for anything out of the ordinary, yeah. Anything super sharp. It could be a metal stud. That's fine. But if part of it is shaved off and into a point somehow, yeah, either maliciously or accidentally, they're looking for things that are not normal to be stepped on with.
It's basically to catch that one time that Sergio Ramos decides to wear running spikes. No, Sergio.
My understanding was, Dan says that the metal studs are legal. Maybe it's certain kinds, because my understanding, Graham, I don't know if you like rugby studs. They're like metal, but they have like a flat end on them as well. So they've got a sharp edge on them. My understanding is certainly in for the English FA, they're not allowed. So they're checking for those. And it's just, as you say, it's a metal screw. It's if someone's, I don't know, taped a jackknife to the bottom of their boots or anything that could be dangerous. Go, Graham.
Sorry, I was just going to say a more kind of common occurrence would maybe be if a player was missing a stud. I think that would also be something that would be raised. So obviously metal studs, for anyone who knows. I mean, it's a long time since I've had a pair of boots, actually. So maybe they've changed boots. But when I was young and played, you used to be able to screw the studs out of the boots and they would come out occasionally. So I guess that would be raised if you were missing a stud.
Does anyone make those kind of cleats anymore? Like, a removable stud still a thing? I don't even know. I haven't seen a pair like that in a long time.
I don't know.
Silence? I
genuinely don't know.
I've always wanted to wear them, but I was kind of scared about using metal cleats and what could happen there. I have broken, what am I not supposed to say?
Cleats. Yeah, the thing you just said, yeah.
Soccer cleats. There you go, Graham. That's for you. Yes, I've broken a stud before and not realized it, and I think that's also what they're checking, because they're checking the player subbing on to make sure they're going to be safe and they're going to be in control of their body, because that player could get hurt, but then also because if that player maybe is missing a key stud in a key moment, they lose control, they fly out of control, and they slam into somebody, and now you've got injuries. So I think they're checking both for, like, deliberate actions that could be negative, but then also unintentional situations. They check underwear too, which is a thing that I always forget about.
Yeah, and you've got Nicholas Bentner to thank for that one.
Yep.
Thanks, Paddy Power. Yeah, that's why we're checking that one. But you're right, it's not just the studs that they're checking. They're checking for things like jewellery as well. And if you look at Law 4, a player's equipment from the FA rulebook, all items of jewellery, necklaces, rings, bracelets, earrings, leather bands, rubber bands, etc., are forbidden and must be removed. Using tape to cover jewellery is not permitted, which is odd because I've seen that plenty of times before. Mm-hmm. The players must be inspected before the start of the match and substitutes before they enter the field of play. And I know I've been at several games where a necklace has to be taken off, or players are asked to remove rings, for example. But I've also seen plenty of times where earrings are taped over. So maybe that is in contrivance with the rules. But what do I know? What do I know? But it's not just the checking of the studs that occurs when a substitute comes on. I think, Taylor, we've pretty much nailed that question, have we not?
I believe we have.
We have indeed. Let's take a quick break, and we'll be back with more shortly.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Total Soccer Show, we are back, and we have a question from Mr. Drew Jordan. Taylor, I'm going to ask you to prick your ears up here for this one, because Drew Jordan is a Man United fan. He says, when I was watching the Euros, it seemed that several United players performed much better for their national teams than for the club, most notably Harry Maguire and Paul Pogba. Is this too small a sample size to judge, or does it point to a larger problem with Manchester United, that perhaps the manager isn't able to get the best out of his players, or that the team strategy isn't putting the players in their best positions to succeed? On a related note, says Drew, both France and England sometimes played a 3-4-1-2. Is that part of why Pogba and Maguire are doing better? And if United were to play a 3-4-1-2, would Aaron Wan-Bissaka work as the right centre back? Taylor.
Yeah. There's a lot going on there.
Yeah.
Which part should we start with?
How about the general concept of players being better for the national team than for Manchester United, which I think is perhaps a valid observation?
Yeah, I think like this answers the question, but maybe I'm splitting hairs. I think it's sort of a difficult question to ask and answer because players can do different things based on what they're being asked to do. And Ole Gunnar Solskjaer might be asking Harry Maguire and Paul Pogba to do a certain thing for the club because that's what they need to do. And then when they play with their national teams, they're being put in an entirely different situation with entirely different players and asked to do something else.
Well, hang on. Can I stop you there? Because it's fair enough to say that of Paul Pogba in a creative position. Mm-hmm. But how different is Harry Maguire's role when he's with United than with England?
Yeah, and I was going to say, like, I think I've even sort of just further outlined the question, which is, like, why does that tend to be the case then? And I think with Harry Maguire, I'm stealing Graham's point. I think he's talked about this before, that having maybe better personnel around you in the immediate areas, specifically right ahead of you as you're holding midfielders, I think it gives him more cover. I think England keeping those sort of two defensive midfielders shielding that back line does a better job than I think Fred and Scott McTominay were trying to do. And I think also with how United have the legacy of being this attack sort of football club, that it's harder to sort of strike that balance. Whereas at international level in a major tournament, I think you would be forgiven, even if you're Gareth Southgate, for going a slightly more defensive route and then having kind of flair attackers to make up the difference. So I think that explains a lot of Harry Maguire. I do think Paul Pogba is a very streaky is the wrong word, but emotional player. And I think he's an incredibly good player and does things that a lot of other people cannot do. But I think he needs the proper motivation and the proper sense of involvement and belief. And I do think that's a thing that hasn't always been prioritized at Man United.
So that's a nicely put way of saying that Pogba isn't given the right materials at United.
I mean, I think he also hasn't put himself in the position to take said materials. I think there's a lot going on with Paul Pogba at Manchester United.
Sorry, right. I was just going to come in. I think that both for both Maguire and Pogba, so they're the two notable examples of players, Man United players playing better for national teams. I'm not entirely sure there are many more who are in that category. I mean, Luke Shaw was very good at the Euros, but he was equally the best left back in the Premier League last season. My son, Scott McTominay, let me tell you, is a lot better for Manchester United than he is for Scotland. That's a criticism made of him, is that he doesn't carry that over into his national team. So Maguire and Pogba are the two examples you would say, and I think they're both linked. I think it's both to do with personnel, and it's actually the same area of the pitch that means they're both they both play better, tend to play better for their national team. So Pogba has N'Golo Kante alongside him. And I just think having that sort of player alongside him takes a lot of the responsibility of the kind of defensive dirty work away from him. And equally, I think Maguire is better for England, or he was better during the Euros, you would say, because he had that platform, as Taylor referenced, of Phillips and Rice in front of him, which I think we could probably all agree is a better midfield partnership than McFred. I think it's purely down to personnel. With Maguire, he has an interesting case, and I think the Varane signing will be a true test of whether or not Solskjaer knows how to use Maguire, because I think a lot of Maguire's problems are down to the players in front of him, and also Victor Lindelof, who just seems to, Lindelof's a decent player, but just seems to bring the worst out of Maguire. And so having Varane, who is for me a top three centre back in the world alongside him, that's going to be a true test of Maguire and also Solskjaer. But Wan-Bissaka at right centre back, if I can address that for a moment, feels like it should work, in that he's one of the best one on one defenders in the Premier League. However, his positional awareness is really quite poor. I mean, how many times do you see him getting caught slightly up the pitch and someone ghosts in at the back post for an opposition team to score? So maybe in practice that one wouldn't actually work.
Joe, what are your thoughts on this question, and maybe on that back three question with Bissaka?
I don't think the back three makes sense for Man United, not because of Bissaka. I think he could do that job fine, and there are issues there that Graham just mentioned. But if you go with a back three, specifically a 3-4-1-2, if you change the shape in front of the back three, it's fine. But the 3-4-1-2 doesn't really make sense with the attacking personnel that Manchester United have. You just pay big bucks for Jadon Sancho and you play a shape without wingers. That doesn't add up to me. You have other talented wide players as well in this roster. Anthony Martial, Marcus Rashford, there's others too. I think you want to stick with that 4-2-3-1 and hopefully pray that you find a Conte-esque, and Esque is carrying a heavy load there, but a Conte-esque kind of player. And you play Pogba next to that guy in the double pivot, and you have Bruno Fernandes in front of them, and then you have Cavani up top and Sancho on one side and probably Rashford on the other. That just seems to make sense to me. I love the points that you guys have made already about why Pogba and Maguire look better for their national teams than they do for Manchester United. It's context, right? It's context around them, and it's the context of those environments. It's just different than it is for Manchester United. The only thing I wanted to add on Pogba is something we've talked about before. He has this incredible skill on the ball. He has incredible vision. He has incredible passing. He's great on the ball, driving it forward. He's so good at exploiting little gaps and creating problems for opposing defenses. Because national teams don't have nearly as much time to train together, their defensive schemes are just weaker. They're easier to exploit. They're easier to break through. And I think that's a big reason why Pogba looks like he's just flowing so much better for France than he does with Manchester United, is because Manchester United are going up against, I don't know, Hull City in the FA Cup, who are packed behind the ball. And in France are playing against Switzerland, who have gaps in their back line. So I think that's another important distinction. The game is just different at international level versus at club level.
That's interesting. And I think it's notable that it's not just Man United and England that this phenomenon happens
No,
with.
Yeah.
When we did our Euro best 11s a few weeks ago, my midfield was Pedri, Højbjerg and Pogba, whom I defined all being better than they were for their domestic teams. It's because they had slightly different roles. And I think you're right. It's because they were coming up against slightly different defenses. And certainly with Pogba and Højbjerg, maybe a bit more pushing forward. Certainly with Højbjerg, they're Joe.
It's different. I just made me smile there thinking about Pedri because he's so good. And it made me happy to think back to that time, Ryan, when he was all in our team of the Euros.
Yeah.
It's a different environment. And I think these two players highlight it well. I hadn't even thought of the Maguire within the England structure and how that helps center backs, not just him, but helps really the rest of England's back line. Different situations, it's hard to compare, even though it's the same players that we're talking about.
Taylor,
and I think
go on.
And I think going back to like the original question we got to start this show about like national teams tend to struggle or would struggle against club teams. I think a lot of that has to do with the club team practicing day in and day out and working on things and learning patterns. And you go here and this half yard and this half step. And you can't really do that when it comes to your national team. So I think you're getting automatically players coming in that understand they have to compromise a little bit and they can't do exactly what they want to do always. I think it gives national team managers a little more flexibility to say, in this specific situation, I need you to do this, even if it's not necessarily a thing you do naturally. It allows this person and this person and this person to play better attacking football, and that's what we want, so that's what we're going to do. I think Solskjaer, for the situation he inherited at Manchester United, and then with Paul Pogba, I think he doesn't have as much freedom to, like, not necessarily cater to what Paul Pogba needs, but if there is a lineup that fits 10 of the 11 players' skill sets, he is going to go with that approach that suits the most players, that gets everybody playing the most cohesive style. And if there are things about that that accentuate strengths of Scott McTominay or Donny van de Beek, it might be the case that they're going to go with that over Paul Pogba because his skill set just doesn't quite fit. But I think it's less accepted at club level because here's this giant marquee player that you spent a ton of money on and now you're not getting the best out of them. That pressure isn't really there at the international level because there's a ton of players, if you're France, who have cost that much money and are equally important, and you could have that conversation in three or four different positions. And so I think to some extent that pressure subsides a little bit. The expectation subsides a little bit, at least until we get later on to the tournament. But I think that pressure is always there for a manager like Solskjaer.
Slight tangent, Tay-Tay. Yesterday morning, I visited a website that Nicholas Bentner likes to advertise on his underwear, and I placed a bet on Manchester United to win the Premier League at 7-1, based mainly on the vibes of Raphael Varane signing.
Yeah,
how do you feel about that?
I would feel better, to the points we've already made, if they had a better holding midfielder who maybe allowed them to do things that they want to do more readily and more easily. Solskjaer, I think, has talked about switching to more of a 4-3-3 instead of that 4-2-3-1. So I don't know who that single pivot would be then. Stands to reason it would be Fred or McTominay. But I don't know if either of them are going to be able to do that job the way it needs to be done. So that would be my lingering area of concern. Maybe I'm just being pessimistic.
Taylor, my prediction is that you're going to get that player in this window.
And I Who would it be, though, Graham?
I think it's going to be Camavinga. I think they're going to go for Camavinga.
Yeah.
All the reports are now that they need to sell. Sorry, we've totally gone off a tangent here. But
no, that's fine.
Now that they've got Varane and Sancho, which, by the way, what a window that is already. But to get, I think they need to sell a couple players. But they've got some sellable assets like Dalot, Lingard, obviously. There's a couple others. And I think that money is going to get put towards Camavinga. And then for the final day of the window, they're going to go for Trippier as a kind of more attacking right back. That, I think, like, that has been like the consistent reports all the way through the window has been over those four players. So it just feels like that's what I think they'll do.
I have slight concerns about Camavinga being able to hold a little bit more and to screen and to shift and become more of a defensive player than a ball progressor, because I think that really is what Manchester United need. But I want to put a caveat there. I need to go back and watch more film because he would be so much fun to watch. I just am not, all of me is not totally sure that he solves the problem, but who knows? We'll find out.
Before you go back and watch more film, Joseph, I'd like you to answer one last question on this listener question show. It comes from David Hulme, who asks, why was Jadon Sancho brought to the Euros over an actual left back or a known locker room presence such as Lingard? And we had a bit of a discussion about this question before we came on air, and there's some separate elements here going on, Joe. Perhaps there's a discussion here about why Jadon Sancho was brought to the Euros, say, over another player, and maybe there's a discussion there about England's use of fullbacks.
I'll start with the fullbacks one, because I'm still a little bit confused by the whole Jadon Sancho situation at the Euros for England. And I think a lot of folks are still at this point. But as far as the left back situation goes, well, actually, let me back up. All of the conversation about England's roster, much of it was tongue in cheek, was about, oh, they have so many right backs. And they did have a lot of right backs on that roster. But they also had left backs. And so maybe David has his wires slightly crossed here, because England, not Manchester United, had Luke Shaw, they had Ben Chilwell, and then Trippier played there as well. And why he played at left back, I don't necessarily know. Maybe he's a little bit more defensive and brought a different look.
It worked.
But they had, it did work. They had left backs. And so I don't think Sancho the Sancho conversation really overlaps into the defense roster construction situation. As far as, you know, why you bring Jadon Sancho instead of another winger who you might play more, I don't know. Something happened along the way to have Jadon Sancho be a permanent fixture on the bench. He started one game at the tournament for England against Ukraine, and that's only because Saka had a little injury. So Saka was the starter on that side. Phil Foden was at first, then Saka played a lot more. Why? I'd be lying to you guys if I said I knew. Jadon Sancho is one of the most talented and best wide attacking players in the world. And he's phenomenal, and I think he would have helped this England team. He has slightly different attributes to Saka, and so maybe that's why Sancho doesn't play. But that wasn't even the question. It's why do you bring Sancho? And why you bring Sancho if you're not going to play him, I guess I'm not as sure about.
Yeah, and I think, Graham, if we're going to talk about Sancho over a known locker room presence such as Jesse Lingard, and Lingard was in the CONCACAF-style 50-man squad before the before the tournament, of course, and he played at least, was it two of the friendlies? I think he played and did very well as well. But going forward, when you're building this England team, you're going to back Sancho, probably?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I think Sancho, I would have played Sancho in more games, as Joe mentions there. He only started one game in the whole tournament. I do think maybe Southgate was mindful of the speculation around his future because it was quite coincidental that as soon as Manchester United announced that they had agreed a deal with Dortmund, and there were a lot of jokes at the time, oh, well, now he's going to start some games for England. And then he did start the next game, against Ukraine after that deal. So I think maybe that speaks to, perhaps he was distracted during the tournament. I'm speculating, obviously, a little bit here, but yeah, it's an interesting one that he wasn't used more. I think maybe just due to the balance of the team. So if you have Sterling on the left and Saka on the right, you know, Sterling likes to he's more likely to cut inside than Saka. So maybe he wants someone to cut inside and link up play on the left, and Saka is more likely to stretch the pitch and maybe burst to the byline on the right, whereas Sancho, if he'd be on the right, would maybe have congested play in the middle a little bit more. He is more of a ball carrier than Saka. He is more of an attacking hub than Saka, as we've seen from him for Dortmund over the past, what, three seasons. So it might just have been down to the balance of the team, and I don't necessarily think putting Lingard in for Sancho, I think in the question it's referenced, you know, how much of a locker room presence Lingard is. But I didn't really get the sense that this England squad was lacking really in that regard at this tournament. It seemed like there was a pretty good spirit, pretty good environment in that dressing room. So I'm not really sure how much they would have needed Lingard. And in terms of having a player who might have offered more as a traditional winger over Sancho, you know, Lingard's not really that player either. He predominantly plays through the middle, actually, rather than kind of out in the wide areas. I know he can do that, but yeah, I would still have picked Sancho over Lingard. I like Lingard, but Sancho is, I know a lot of people hate this word, this term, but if I'm going to use it, he is a bit of a generational talent for England, and I think he's going to be one of their best players for the next 10 years.
I agree with that, Graham. I agree with your sort of everything you said. I would be a little bit shorter on saying he's a generational talent, just because, like, again, now that he's a Man United player, I think I'm automatically like, it's not going to work. Everything's going to be bad. but it is strange to say about a player of that quality that we're basically talking about the 22nd or 21st player on the roster, maybe even the 23rd. And I think that is something to consider, that when you look at the depth of talent England had and has, like, there is cover in a number of different positions. And I think for Southgate, it probably came down to, like, there are two positions left and I've got four or five different names that could fit there. And so then you look at, where do I already have depth? Where do I already have cover? And I think it's worth remembering that England, I think Luke Shaw maybe was carrying an injury or wasn't at full fitness. And I think that's part of why Trippier starts on the left. But also, there's Ben Chilwell then as the depth, but he has to be sidelined or quarantining, and so then he's not involved, and I think that's a little bit of an unforeseen circumstance. But you have left-back cover, you certainly have right-back cover, there's a ton of depth in the middle. Lest we forget, Mason Mount is probably going to start somewhere on that pitch, usually as a number 10, and so suddenly the positions fill up really, really quickly, because you're always going to start Harry Kane if you're Southgate, you're probably going to start Raheem Sterling if you're Gareth Southgate, and so then your team is sort of selected, and then you're looking at alternates and sort of depth. And I think there's probably a thinking of if Harry Kane can't go, if he gets injured, we have Dominic Calvert-Lewin. But if we need a more sort of mobile, fast-paced, attacking, like, triumvirate, I can see a world in which he thought, I'll put Raheem Sterling central, Raheem Sterling on the left, Marcus Rashford central, and then Jadon Sancho out wide, and we'll attack with pace or counterattack with pace or what have you. And I think probably Jadon Sancho just gave him that one different look that made it, like, even more of a lock for him to be in this squad. I think he would have been anyway, because I do also think optics are part of this. And if he brings Lingard over Sancho, the minute that becomes a problem, the minute Jadon Sancho could have scored a goal against Scotland, but instead Jesse Lingard was there, he knows he's getting hit for that. And I don't think it's a major factor, but I think it is a factor. And so I think all those combine as to why Jadon Sancho was in that squad.
Gents, I think we just got through a conversation about England's attacking midfield options without mentioning the words Jack or Grealish. So congratulations to all of us in that one.
I believe Phil Foden. Did we get Phil Foden in there?
I don't think we did.
I think I said it once.
Okay, yeah. Thanks, Joe.
Yep.
Wonderful stuff, gentlemen. I think that just about wraps up our listener questions for this moment. Taylor Rockwell, thank you so much for your contribs instead of contributions today. I haven't got time for a whole word there, clearly.
Welts.
Joe, you too.
Oh, you got it, Ryan. Thank you.
G.
I'm off back to my Olympics dungeon. Along with the US men's basketball team.
Oh, I'm picturing something very sinister now. Okay, bye!